Okay, so five past already. So it's time for this morning's Dharma talk on payday on Friday the 13th. It's Friday the 13th today. That's unlucky for your defilements, but it's lucky for you. So today is a wonderful day to make the final push, or rather gentle stopping, to get to enlightenment. Last night somebody asked the question about the place of wisdom on the path. I did mention something about that coming at the end of jhanas. But it's also I should have said, and I was surprised no one pointed out to me, that there is also the beginning of the path, the necessity of some basic wisdom, basic right view, to get the whole process going. And if you look at the usual definitions of the initial stages of right view, they always say the belief in karma and rebirth, but especially in karma. And we sort of think about that. Why is that so essential? It is because that this is a path which you have to walk. You can't expect just to sit. You can expect to sit there and do nothing. So what is the place of karma there if you're not supposed to do anything? And the point is that there is the karma of the world, you know, which gets you success, makes you fit and healthy or whatever. But there is also the karma of meditation, and that's a real tough one to figure out. It is the karma where you take responsibility to do nothing. That you initiate the stopping. That you make the letting go happen. Now that's an incredible, subtle form of karma. Because the letting go, the abandoning, the letting go of that itch is all something which you do, or rather you initiate. And it's actually how you create that letting go is a key to understanding the path towards enlightenment. It is karma, but it is a karma of stopping, a karma of restraint, a karma of letting go, a karma of gentleness, a karma of stillness. And if you don't initiate that, just the world goes around as it normally does. You find yourself always doing things, getting involved, planning, and all sorts of stuff. For example, as I said last night, the retreat is a long way from being over. Sometimes you think, what is it? It's a day and a half, 36 hours. That's not 36 hours. Look at under 2,000 minutes. Not 2,000 minutes. Look at us 120,000 seconds. And every second you've got a chance to be enlightened. That's 120,000 chances you have between now and tomorrow afternoon. Wow, what a lot of chances that are. So do not waste even a second of this. Because you find that's the nature of human beings. We're always one or two steps, usually a couple of kilometers ahead of ourselves. And what a waste of our life that is. And throughout our life, we're always people who are moving on to the next thing. Always never here. Always planning what we're going to do next. And how much of our life we've wasted that way. I still recall when I was a school teacher, one of my fellow teachers, he didn't like being a school teacher, even at a nice high school. So he went from sublime to ridiculous. He decided to get a job as a tax inspector. And he got the job, but he couldn't start until the contract at school finished, so he had 6 months he had to wait. I remember he came up to me one day and he said, "There's 5 months until I leave this place, and I found myself wishing away months of my life." And it scared him just how he was doing that. You've only got 80 years, that's only 960 months. How come you waste and wish away months and months, a significant part of your life? And that was a great insight for him, to be able to live more in the moment. I don't know how many more days you've got left, but certainly you can't wish away a day and a half. This is really important. And so what meditation, what this whole process is teaching you, is to stop going on, always going in. To stop and start enjoying where you are. And you can do that. You can achieve that. That's the job of the karma. That's where you take the responsibility to change the way you live your life and be more in the moment, more in the present, more with where you are, especially when you don't have to go forward and plan. The moment you don't have to do anything. And it's when we do this incredible stopping, we get from that karma, we got the insight, the wisdom on what the karma for enlightenment is. It's not striving and struggling. It's that ability, that skill to stop and let go. To be able to enjoy the last days, the last moments of everything, instead of always moving on to somewhere else. We know just how, just to rest, to leave things alone. And when you start to do that, the whole meditation becomes natural, very easy. Sometimes that I was always, it's not sometimes always, that's an oxymoron, that I was interested in some of the old tales of monks and nuns who became enlightened and how they did it. And it was fascinating to read some of their stories. And how, and this will encourage each one of you, if you read these stories in the Theragata and Terigata, unfortunately the translations are very, very old and stilted, but nevertheless you can get some idea of what they were talking about. Actually those old books, they really deserve a new translation because they're very, very inspiring. But especially in the Bhikkhuni Terigata about the enlightened nuns. I started reading about these nuns, and I have the poems, one after the other, the nuns who became enlightened and how they managed it. And nun after nun, in this list there, they were saying they'd been meditating for years and getting nowhere. Now that makes you feel okay, because you've been only meditating for 8 days, and you're getting nowhere. But then, they said that this great bhikkhuni, this great nun, came along and then taught them how to meditate properly. And then within days they were becoming enlightened, one after the other. And then what that told me, that there is like a skill, a trick, you just turn the attention slightly and then you get it. And that's what you spend 8 days doing, trying to get that sort of letting go button push, finding out where it is, learning how to stop, learning how to get rid of this controller, to stop doing it and allow it to happen. And when you can actually find that, the enlightenment process becomes very swift. Now, at the beginning of the retreat, I encourage you to, whenever you feel tired, to rest. And it wasn't just, you know, to be kind to you and just to indulge you, but it also is a nice way of becoming enlightened. That's a great story of Ananda will illustrate. Because Ananda was the Buddha's attendant for the last 25 years of the Buddha's life. And so went all around with the greatest teacher that has lived. And by the time the Buddha passed away, Ananda still wasn't enlightened. Imagine that. You know, you've got the best teacher ever. And you're right with them, not just for 8-9 days, for 25 years. And he still doesn't get it. And so you can imagine what happened when the Buddha passed away. He thought, if I can't become enlightened when the Buddha was alive, how can I become enlightened now? And he really got sort of fed up. But he was so busy afterwards with all the arrangements for the funeral and messing around afterwards. But then something happened. That one of the monks, who was Mahakasapa, decided that all the great monks should meet together so they can collect all of those sayings and sermons which they remembered from the Buddha. This was the days before MP3. And they had to just come together and recite and try and memorize it. And also the rules, I mean what monks are supposed to do and what the nuns are supposed to do. They get it all together and let's have like a conference. So they arranged this convention. And just for a nice number, they said 500. Now if you're going to have 500 people coming for this convention, you just want the creme de la creme, the arahats, the enlightened ones. So they decided to get all the enlightened ones. But they thought, Ananda, he's heard so much and knows so much, we'll make an exception, we'll invite him as well. So he got an invitation. 499 fully enlightened beings, and then Ananda, the odd one out. Now, because he wasn't enlightened, he still had pride. You'll be the same that you would feel if I made the announcement that of all the people on this retreat, everyone had got fourth jhana and got fully enlightened except for you. How would you feel? You would feel, wow, I'd better do something about this. And that's what Ananda thought. The following day was a conference, and he thought, I'm going to give it everything I've got. Just like the last day of a retreat. One more day to go. I want to get something out of this. I can't go home thinking, everyone else is enlightened and not me. So he really gave it super effort. He meditated all night, no sleeping. Sitting, walking, sitting, trying his best. And when the dawn came up, he still was not enlightened. What a bummer. As they say in Australia. So what did he do? He just gave up. What's the point? So he went down to take a nap before the conference started. And for those of you who know the story, as he decided to take a nap, just before his head hit the pillow, he became fully enlightened, an arahat. He let go at last. And to prove to all of his 499 friends he was enlightened, he came late for the meeting. They closed the door and only 499 people were in the room. And he came in through the keyhole. Using psychic powers to show, yes guys, I'm one of you. Now, you have one day left to try the Ananda method of enlightenment. Take a nap. Many of you tried that many times. It hasn't worked yet. But that's a true story. But why did it happen? Why, when he was trying so hard, he couldn't get enlightened, but then when he decided to take a nap, it suddenly came? And of course, the reason is because at that time, he let go. He gave up. He stopped trying. He stopped. And it's in that stopping, that karma of stopping, and you actually see the Dhamma, you see the truth. And a few of you have experienced something like that, obviously not full enlightenment, but something like that, when you have stopped, when you stopped trying, when you sat there and let go, and the meditation started to happen. You become really peaceful, and it's no effort. You really enjoy it. If you just stop a little bit more, and stop a little bit more, and wait a bit, then enlightenment is yours. To understand that even more, there is this great simile which I invented some years ago. One of my favorite ones. It's the simile of the donkey and the carrot. Because in Europe, the usual means of transport 100 years ago, especially in southern Europe, were donkey carts. And if you try and make a donkey move, if you shout at it or hit it or beat it, it will not move. That's why they say you are stubborn as a donkey. And that's why that we don't beat you, we don't shout at you, because if we did, you'd just be as stubborn as ever. So instead of using the stick, what the owner of the donkey does is ties that stick to the donkey's back. And the front of the stick is about 2 feet in front of the donkey's head. On the end of that stick, they put a string. And on the end of the string, a juicy carrot. And the donkey sees that carrot in front. And what does the donkey do? He starts moving towards it. But as he moves towards it, the stick moves, the string moves, and so does the carrot. Doesn't matter how much the donkey strives and runs and chases, that carrot is always 2 feet in front of the donkey. And that's how they get the donkey to move. And that's how life has got you to move. the carrot of success, fulfillment, happiness, whatever, is always one or two days in front of you when the retreat finishes. You're chasing that carrot now. Whatever it is, we're always chasing something in front of us. And you may find in all the years you've lived, happiness, you can see it, but it's just out of reach. You move towards it, and it moves away from you. Such is life. However, about 50 years ago, according to this story, when Buddhism started spreading to Europe, the donkeys learned how to catch the carrot. That's why they don't have donkey carts anymore. They have internal combustion automobiles. And how the donkey learned to catch the carrot is how you learn to become still in your meditation and how you learn to become enlightened. It is the story of Ananda. The donkey who wants to catch the carrot chases after it, running after it with full speed, with maximum effort. But does that make the carrot come any closer? Doesn't matter how hard you strive and run, the carrot is always 2 feet in front. But Buddhist donkeys, they know how to stop and wait. And that's what Buddhist donkey does. He stops and waits. And what happens when you stop and let go in this meditation retreat? The carrot goes further away from you. Whenever you come on a retreat like this and you do this letting go business, sometimes your meditation goes all over the place. Sometimes you get slothful and restless and you think, oh, it's all going wrong. Wait. Even though that carrot soon goes further away than it's ever been before, maybe 4 feet in front of you, you wait. Because something strange happens next. When the carrot goes to the top of its arc, it stops. And then it starts coming towards you. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to shake the mango tree. You just got your hand up. And the carrot starts coming towards you. You're sitting there and you're getting more and more peaceful, more and more blissful, and you're not doing anything. The carrot of enlightenment is coming. The paycheck, you can see it coming towards you. And soon, that carrot is at its normal distance from you, just 2 feet. Your meditation is just as it normally was, but now it's getting very still and peaceful, all by itself, very fast. It's coming towards you. And the important thing here is when those nimittas come up, when you're getting very close, don't do anything, don't chase it. All you need to do is to be so still, and just at the right moment, you remember the door of my mouth is open to you, carrot. Come in. And you open your mouth, and the carrot goes in, and you close your mouth, and now you're enlightened. The carrot's come towards you, because you've learned how to stop. Now that is the great wisdom of knowing what the path is, knowing how it works, knowing that to end craving, you've got to stop and see what it's like when you stop craving. Because the whole myth of craving is that you can get what you want, as long as you try hard enough. Sometimes it's worked in the past, but a lot of the time it hasn't, and it doesn't really work. Because as soon as you've got some craving and you get that, you want something else. Somebody said years and years ago that craving is always unfaithful to its object. It's unfaithful. Craving sees something, it wants it and thinks, once I get you, that's all I want. I'll be happy now. And as soon as you get it, you want something else. That's the nature of craving, to be unfaithful. So it's endless. So one day we get the idea, if we really want to be happy, how about stopping and see what it's like to stop chasing the carrot. And then the carrot comes towards you. So this whole retreat, you've been learning how to stop chasing. Which is why that when people have come in for the interviews and they say, I feel terrible, I'm going crazy, I tell them, oh, that's really good. When they come in and they say, I've just got jhana, I say, oh, that's really good. Whatever they say, I say, oh, that's really good. Because I want people to stop chasing things and just allow things to be, to stop the chasing. Because that's what you do in ordinary life. And this is the great wisdom which the Buddha found under the Bodhi tree, to learn how to sit still, both physically and mentally. Stillness becomes the path. But how do we become still? And the stillness comes from this wonderful sense of contentment, realizing that contentment is the highest happiness of all. Sometimes that we think that whenever we have a problem we have to do something about it. A lot of times when you're still, that's the best solution to many of the problems. As I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh once said, don't just do something, sit there. In other words, sometimes the activities which we do in life just make things worse. And sometimes just sitting there letting go, being kind, is the best solution of all. Now sometimes when people do meditation, sometimes they do feel like they're going crazy, they're going mad. I haven't mentioned this simile yet, but it fits in here. And it's called the simile of the attack of all the defilements and kilesas all at once. As if all of your defilements have been waiting, grouping up and attacking you all together. You have greed, hatred, sloth and torpor, restlessness, doubt, everything all at once. Because that's what it is like when sometimes people think they're going crazy and they get so frustrated. People have times like that. The attack of all the defilements. And the way to overcome that attack and all other attacks of craziness, restlessness, pain, depression or whatever, is to use what I call the Nalagiri strategy. Coming from the old Buddhist story of Nalagiri the elephant, who was given alcohol by the Buddha's enemies, who'd made drunk and then let loose in the streets when the Buddha was coming in the opposite direction on arms round. And any of you, especially from Sri Lanka, who went to Dharma school as a kid, you remember that story of Nalagiri the elephant chasing down the road in the path of the Buddha. And of course, people ran away from that elephant when they saw him coming. And they warned the Buddha and the monks, there's an elephant coming, get out of the way. And of course, many of the monks ran away. Some climbed up trees. Some jumped over fences. And sometimes that happens in Thailand, because I don't know why it is, but the water buffalo are somehow afraid of monks. And sometimes when they see a monk, they spook. I don't know if it's like the colour of the robes, they think it's a tiger because they've got bad eyesight, I'm not sure. But sometimes when they see a monk, they put their head up, which is a sign they're getting very afraid, and sometimes they charge towards the monks. And I remember them charging me once. I was first year at Wat Nanachat, and I was walking with Ajahn Sumedho, and this buffalo charged us. And I was really stupid, because I parted from Ajahn Sumedho. And he had much better karma than I did. I should have just hid behind him. So, of course, the water buffalo left Ajahn Sumedho alone and started charging me. It was a very dumb thing to do. But I just hid behind a tree, and the water buffalo stopped. But sometimes like monks actually do get hit by the water buffalo and gored. I don't know why that is. But they're very dangerous because they're very heavy beings. And imagine like an elephant. That's even stronger. So this elephant was charging towards the Buddha. All the monks, they ran away and jumped over fences. All except for Ananda. He was the Buddha's attendant. And he loved the Buddha. So he did this amazing act of self-sacrifice. He stood in front of his teacher, his master. He put his arms out and said, let the elephant kill me. I will protect my beloved master. Venerable Lata, would you do that for me? I doubt it. Would you?
No, you'd be up the trees first of all.
But the Buddhists have gently pushed Ananda aside, and it's very sweet of you to do that, but I can handle this. So Ananda's great gesture of self-sacrifice didn't really work, and he was pushed out of the way. And so the Buddha was facing the fierce, intoxicated, huge elephant Nalagiri, who was charging towards him. And the Buddha was just standing there, and people were watching, like a contest, you know, like one of these wrestling contests or whatever, sort of like Godzilla meets the monster from the deep or whatever. But this was the Buddha versus Nalagiri. What would happen next? Now, as the elephant came closer, what would the Buddha do? Now, the Buddha had great psychic powers. There's no doubt about that. If the Buddha had wanted to, he could have picked up Nalagiri by the trunk, twirled him 3 times around his head, and thrown him over the Ganges River. He could have even thrown him over the Swan River in Perth if he wanted. But did the Buddha do that? Did the Buddha use the force of his psychic powers? What the Buddha did, he gave Nalagiri the elephant loving kindness. Nalagiri, the door of my heart is fully open to you, or something like that. Whatever you do, if you trample me, if you pick me up with your trunk and smash me on the ground or against a tree, if you gore me with your tusks, I will always love you and forgive you. The door of my heart, Nalagiri, is unconditionally open to you no matter what you ever do. That's what we call like loving kindness. And those of you who remember the story know that in the next second, Nalagiri the elephant had lost his intoxication and was bowing down before the Buddha, allowing the Buddha to stroke his head. There, Nalagiri. There, Nalagiri. There, Nalagiri. Completely pacified. Now, what that story means, when your mind is intoxicated, crazy, running towards you, threatening to trample you, squash you, gore you, lift you up and smash you on the ground, because sometimes the mind feels like that. Don't try and use your power to stop it. Instead say, dear crazy mind, the door of my heart is fully open to you. Even if you kill me and drive me crazy, I will still give you unconditional love. Now if you do that degree of loving kindness, absolute 100% acceptance and letting go and being at peace, your crazy mind, no matter how crazy it is, within a second, will be just bowing down before you. As you stroke your mind, their mind, their mind, their mind. And that's how it works. Simply because you know how to stop, let go with kindness. And nothing can resist that. The Nalagiri strategy for letting go of the difficulties and the problems. So as you've been meditating here, you've been learning so much. Not learning so much how to control things with force or with your powers, psychic or not. You do learn through this powerful meditation how to make peace and how to let go and how to be still and how to let things happen. There's also, and it fits in here as well, just a few loose ends, which I said I would talk about but forgot about every morning. There's also sometimes a time in meditation when strange things happen. When any strange or weird thing happens in your meditation, you don't try and stop it or force it. Again, use loving kindness and be at peace with it, be still with it. I've already mentioned that sometimes when your perceptions go a bit weird, when you think you're expanding, that's a common one. Your whole body or part of your body expands and balloons up. Just the door of my heart is open to your body. Or if it starts exploding, like once happened to Ajahn Chah, when he was meditating, he saw the vision of his whole body exploding. and the liver was on a tree, and his heart was in pieces on the twigs, and his whole body had gone boom and bang. He said, okay, that's okay. Door my heart's, well actually, there's no heart to open the door to, but it's still okay. He's at peace with these things. And eventually all that stuff came back together again, he got out of meditation. So it's just on your vision in the mind. So make peace with it. Be still with it. You don't go crazy except if you fight it. It's in the fighting and resisting that it becomes difficult and painful. But there's another part of meditation which is when the body starts to do strange things. Because it's happened on a meditation retreat. I've seen some people, they start sitting in a nice posture. And by the end of the posture, they're all contorted. The first time I saw this, I thought, gee, that guy's going to hurt when they come out of meditation. I asked them afterwards, you know, you're just in a really weird position. That must have been very uncomfortable. And they come out and said, actually, that was just really peaceful. I had a very lovely meditation. I feel really great. And I've seen it so many times, and I've seen a lesser amount in my own body, this thing happen. But what happens is when you really rest the mind and you get very still and peaceful, literally, you're getting out of the way. And then the body will contort itself or do strange things because that's what the body needs to do a lot of the time just to heal itself. In the Indian and Chinese idea of medicine, or rather of sickness, they keep on saying all sickness is a blockage of energies in the body. In Indian medicine, they call it the winds going through the body. In Chinese they call it the qi, the energy flows. And all illnesses is when those energy flows are blocked. And what happens is sometimes in meditation the body understands this, but you don't understand, and the body twists and turns to open up a channel of energy. And it has to do that for some reason or other, because usually that channel is closed up, it has to open up, and then things start to flow, which is why people feel so good afterwards. But the more common experience, instead of like twisting and turning, your arms going up, whatever, to release energy blockages, more common than that is when you get hot spots in your body. Like parts of your body which get really, really warm, like a localized inflammation. And when people keep asking me about that, I've seen meditation, I've got so hot, just in my shoulder. What's going on? And of course I know exactly what's going on now. It was here a couple of years ago, when somebody came up to me and said, my whole shoulders and back were just so hot. And so I said, well, when did you have the accident? Were you injured your back? And they looked at me and said, psychic powers, Ajahn Brahma's read my mind. I said, no, I haven't read your mind, you just told me, because that's obvious that what happens if you had an injury like that in the past, in meditation, you really get out of the way, and the body can send energy there to heal it. And it's great. And they said, afterwards you felt really good. I said, yeah, I felt so nice in that area, so relaxed. Because that happens very often. If you've got an injury or a sickness, you're sitting in meditation, you have to get still and peaceful, get out of the way, then you get hot spots in the body. And all that is energy going up there to heal you. And sometimes you don't think there's anything wrong there. Very often it's some incipient disease, which you don't even know about. Like a lady with maybe breast cancer. Hasn't happened yet, but that part gets very hot and stops it happening in the first place. That heat in those parts of the body is a healing energy. Simply because you're letting go, you're relaxing, getting out of the way, and allowing the body to heal itself. Same principle as Nalagiri. Same principle as stopping letting go. There's so many positive things happen when you relax and rest and allow things to flow instead of getting in their way. And that's usually what happens. We get in the way of enlightenment. We get in the way of peace. We get in the way of our meditation sometimes. We just go really, really well. And we think, what should we do next? Going really, really peaceful. And we think, great, I have to tell my friends about this. Whatever it is, you tend to spoil it again and again and again. Rather learning how to be like that donkey, stop and stay stopped, and let these things occur and happen. Once one understands this, one understands the path, and the little experiences you get on this retreat, when you actually follow the instructions and you find it works, or you get those hot spots in the body, or you find yourself contorting and feel so good afterwards, will actually show you just this path of letting go is the path towards peace, real happiness and enlightenment itself. And later on, when you add all those little insights up, they get stronger and stronger, and they lead to you to deeper states of letting go. And the deepest stages of letting go you go to in the jhanas, they just really show you just what real peace and happiness are. The more you let go, the more you disappear, the happier you are. And sometimes we wonder why we didn't see this in our life before, thinking that we run after things, we get happy. When we accumulate things, we get happy. When we do a lot, then we become more successful, so we think. And then we come in our retreat, we sit down and do nothing, we let go of everything. We try not to own things, and everything becomes so peaceful and so happy. We learn the secret of real happiness. What we're learning here is not just the secret of real happiness, we're also learning about this idea of a self. This is the core thing inside of us, which actually makes us do things. Some of you have got very still in your meditation, it's as if you're disappearing. It's true that sometimes that the more we do, the more we exist, at least the more we think we exist. And so it's sometimes very frightening to actually to do nothing. That's one of the biggest obstacles, because to do nothing, we have to disappear. The self is that which does. It is the doer in chief. And here we learn how to stop all of that. But what happens is the fear of letting go of yourself is balanced by the joy of letting go. You know that sometimes I said that on the door into jhanas, that sometimes there is the two obstacles, excitement and fear, and I said the fear is the biggest one. You know what the great fear is? The great fear is disappearing, of yourself going and vanishing. It's as if that there you have the opportunity to go into the incredible powerful bliss states, but to enter is an entrance fee, and that entrance fee is you. You have to let go of your sense of self and who you think you are to enter those jhanas. And that's why that sometimes it's like you're standing on the brink. You're looking into this incredible bliss and joy, but you know that you have to let go of something which is very dear to you, your identity. But the way that things happen, the joy, the bliss is just too great. It's a joy and happiness. The sheer pleasure of it will actually overcome that fear and draw you in spite of all your misgivings. It will draw you in because you can't resist such huge and pure happiness. And you go in there and eventually you find out, hey, it didn't really matter so much, letting go of this thing I called me. It was only an illusory self anyway. It is the illusion of self which stops you getting enlightened, which makes you do things. You really think you're there because you've been conditioned and thought that way for so long. You really think that you're in charge. You really think that you're the one who knows. And you've been knowing this all week, all year. There's something inside of you which is always the same. Always has been the same. Your body changes. Maybe your knowledge changes and grows. But there's something essentially inside of you which is always the same. When some of that starts to disappear, that's what shocks you. In the jhanas, things disappear, like I already mentioned, like the water around the tadpole disappears when it becomes a frog. And then it realized that the water wasn't essential. It was always there, but now it's not there. So it's the same as this thing which is always here, our sense of self. When that starts to disappear, it shocks us and we realize that was a bit of an illusion. And as we go deeper, again it shocks us more and more. The other simile which I gave, it's like you're watching a TV. And on the TV, there are five channels. There is the sight channel, there's the sound channel. Channel 3 is smell channel. Channel 4 is taste, and channel 5 is the touch, the feeling channel. And there's the 5 channels on the TV, and sometimes you can turn the TV off, and so there's not 5 channels there, there's just the last channel, the basic channel, the mind channel. And sometimes you understand that impermanence, yeah, the programs come and go, you can flip from channel to channel, but then one day a strange thing happens. You're watching the TV, and the TV set vanishes. It disappears. And it's not meant to do that. And it's not covered in the warranty. TV sets aren't supposed to just vanish into thin air. But it does. And you've seen it. That's why some of these deep meditations are very shocking. Things which are always supposed to be there, now are not. Yourself has vanished. And these are the insights, these are the experiences which when you come out of these deep meditations afterwards, they give you the wisdom which is very, very rare in the world. What is real and what is illusory? Sometimes we just assume on the basis of our experience there's always somebody here because it feels that way. But you go into these rare states of mind and it's plain, it's clear. There was no one there to begin with. From this side of jhanas, that might sound scary. I don't want to go. I don't want to disappear. I don't want to become enlightened. I like my movies, I like my sex, I like my food. I've got too many things to do. I'll become enlightened later on in life. Once I've enjoyed everything, after my menopause, then I'll become enlightened. Oh, never. No, it don't work that way. The sooner the better. There's a truth there. And this is like the wisdom, the great wisdom which comes from the deep meditations. And quite frankly, you can't get to it any other way. Simply just haven't got enough data. You can't see through. The tadpole just can't know that water is water until it's got out, at least for the first time. Which is why in this retreat I also teach, just to encourage people to go for broke. Go for those jhana experiences, even just one of them. You don't have to go jhana every moment of a retreat. Because like insight is just like you're on this side of a big barrier, a big wall which is higher than you. You can't see over the other side. You don't know what's on the other side. You just got to jump high enough to see over the wall. Just need to jump over once, high enough to see over, to get a glimpse of what's on the other side. This is what I mean by just getting into the jhana once, just to see what's on the other side, to get a glimpse of enlightenment, to know it for yourself. And when you do this, this is what happens. All those teachings of the Buddha which you know, you've read or heard about, all those things which you say, it doesn't make any sense to me, that can't be right. And even if you're afraid of these things, after a while when you see over the wall, you see exactly what they mean. And it's nothing to do with fear. It's real happiness, real enlightenment, real freedom. Freedom from desires. Free at last. In that book, which I wrote, The Mindfulness Bliss and Beyond, I gave this wonderful story about what enlightenment is. I think I got this from a Canadian monk a long time ago, but I can't really remember. And he once gave the story of the kids playing the wishing game. And it's a very evocative story, simply because it shows the difference between the life in the world and the life of an arahat. What it's like to be enlightened. And the 5 children playing the wishing game. Well, the 5 kids had this wishing game. The idea is, the one who makes up the best wish will win the wishing game. I always try and change this story every time. So, the first kid was sitting there and thinking, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a big bowl of dim sum. Usually I say McDonald's or ice cream, because there's many people from Singapore here. A nice dish of dim sum. That's what I want if I have a wish. Especially because you may have been here for 6 or 7 days eating Western vegetarian food and saying, oh, only a couple of days left and I'm back in Singapore, and maybe already planning your first meal when you get off the plane into Singapore. Someone is hiding their head. So, the first kid said, oh, I wish for a nice big dish of dim sum. And the second kid has longer to think. If I had a wish, I'd wish for a whole restaurant. And a whole restaurant, I can not just get a dish of dim sum. I can get the whole menu. And if I own a restaurant, I can get this food any time I want, whenever I want it, not just one little plate of dim sum. And of course, that's a far more superior wish, to own the whole restaurant. So then they asked child number three, if you had a wish, what would you wish for? And the third child, his daddy was an accountant. So he thought, if I had a wish, I'd wish for $5 billion. US, not Singaporean. Worth more. Because it's $5 billion. He's only a little kid, maybe 6 or 7 year old. With $5 billion, I could buy my own restaurant. I'd get that first of all. Then with my next wish, I'll buy my own video game store. Do you like playing video games? But you know that kids playing video games, their mothers never allow them the time to play, because they have to go to school. So he said, with $5 billion, after buying a restaurant, a video game store, I still have heaps left over. So then I'll buy a school. I'll buy my own school. And I don't have to go there. And I can always write myself nice reports every year and give myself top grades, because I own the school. And then when I get old enough, I'll sell the school and buy a college. You know, like they're doing in the United States. You know, anyone can get a degree from the United States, give them enough money. So they said that I can get a degree as well, and I can play video games all day long, up until I'm 30 or 40. And of course, with $1 billion, or $5 billion US, I mean, you can actually, you'll never use all that up. For your whole life, you'll always have something left. So as a kid with a $5 billion wish, is that what you would want? $5 billion? Would that be enough? There's two more kids left, and each of those kids got a wish which was better than a $5 billion wish. The third kid was very, very smart, and said, if I had a wish, I would wish for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'd have the Chinese restaurant. For the second wish, I'd have the $5 billion US. And for my third wish, I would have three more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. He was a kid who had the infinity of wishes. And that obviously is far more superior than the $5 billion wish. Now that is the ultimate wish in the world, to have all of your wishes given to you. The infinity of wishes granted. But that was only child number four. That's what most people aspire for in the world. When they become rich, then they usually become politicians. You know why that is? Because the rich people, they have some power just with billions of dollars, but then they still haven't got the ability to get everything they wish for, even with money. So become a politician, then you have more power, especially if you're a dictator. Then you have the infinity of wishes. Whatever I wish for, it comes. Or they wish to be a god with ultimate power. Whatever I wish for, it's given to me. Now that, for most people, is the ultimate. They want to go to some heaven world, some pure land, where everything they wish for, whenever they wish for it, is always granted. The infinity of wishes, always granted. That is only child number four. Child number five did even better and eventually won the wishing game. Had a much better idea than just the infinity of wishes. The fifth child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed a wish ever again. I'm so content I don't even need any wishes. And they all agreed that beat the infinity of wishes wish. Do you understand? Wanting this and wanting that and wanting something else is nowhere near as peaceful and happy
of being so content you want for nothing? How much money do you need to want for nothing? Doesn't matter. It's how many desires you have. So the last kid who wanted to be so content, never needed any more wishes, was the Buddha. Enlightened, being so content, I don't want anything anymore. This is always good enough. You may not like it, you may like it, but you can always be content with it. It's good enough. Now you understand what enlightenment is. It's beautiful contentment when you want for nothing. So happy. On the opposite, this is called the freedom from desires. The other one, the freedom of desires, can sometimes be so painful. I still remember reading, I was told by a guy at an airport came up to me once. We had a conversation, I think it was actually in Bangkok airport, the old one, many years ago. And he came and told me, because he was a guy from the Middle East, there's a very famous and very mean curse in the Middle East. I don't know where they got this from, but I thought, wow, that's the worst thing you can curse a person with. If you really want to get mean to somebody, give them this curse. May you always get what you want as soon as you want it. May you always get what you want as soon as you want it. That will drive a person crazy. Think about it. It's much better, may I have no more wishes. Being free from the irritation of always wanting something else. And be so content, you're happy to be here. And that is not only the meaning of enlightenment. That also shows you what the path to enlightenment is. So in this retreat, you're practicing what it feels like to be enlightened, if you can. To be so content, just sitting here, even with a restless mind, with a dopey mind, with whatever mind, you're just happy to be here. Completely content. Not wanting anything. If you perfect that 100% in this moment, you get a taste of what it's like to be enlightened. If you maintain that for long enough, this beautiful contentment, letting go, I have no wishes to go anywhere, to get jhanas, to get anything. You get so still that jhanas come to you like the carrot comes into the mouth of a donkey. So still, because you're not wanting anything. So content. And the whole path of meditation is building contentment upon contentment upon contentment. Like a fire, it builds up. And it gets so strong, the mind becomes brilliant. Empowered by contentment. Stilled by letting go. And completely satisfied, because not wanting anything. The mind becomes radiant, blissful. You get a taste of what enlightenment feels like. The ultimate happiness, said the Buddha, is Nibbana. Contentment is another description, the end of all desires, the stopping of the round. Finished, done, ended. So, you have another. About, how much did I say? Another 118,000 seconds to go. So, 118,000 opportunities to stop and become fully enlightened, just like Ananda. So, when this talk is finished, go back to your room, lay down. If it doesn't work, get up and lay down again. And if that doesn't work, what I usually say at the end of any meditation retreat, it's a time where you get people to hide the clotheslines. Yeah. You know that story. There was another nun by the name of, I think, Siha the nun. Siha means like lion or lioness. And she was 7 years as a nun. And again, she was fed up. Never a moment's peace in those 7 years meditating. So she didn't want to go back to the three crooked things. She had enough of that. But then she couldn't stand it as a nun any longer. So when she couldn't go back to her house and she couldn't stand it as a nun, there was only one thing left to do. She took the rope and went in to the depth of the forest. She climbed a tree and tied one end of the rope to a branch, tied the other one around her neck. And she was just about to jump off when she got it. She got enlightened. That was a close shave, and I don't recommend it. If it doesn't work for you, we're in big trouble. But sometimes it feels like that. And the point is, let go. You don't have to jump off the tree to let go. But just, I'll let go now. See if you can stop and just allow things to be. Allow contentment to build up. That is the path, that is the wisdom which comes because it works. The wisdom of experience. You try it, every time you really do it properly, it works. You get so peaceful and so still. And that gives you the insight into what enlightenment is. Keep on going. Take it to its limit. And see how content you can truly be. Absolutely still. Fully enlightened. Gone. Okay, so any questions and comments about this talk this morning of getting you the last piece of the jigsaw on how to become enlightened before the end of this retreat? Any comments or questions? Okay, that's it. Okay, you got one. Okay, yes. So. Yeah, so when your hair's on fire, what do you do? Put it out. So put it out.
Could you emphasize the death?
Yes.
But I'm also wondering, is it the case that in the modern world, we've been so striving,
yes,
and organizing and problem solving, that we've become kind of a bit unbalanced in that? We can kind of do that naturally, and so all you've got to emphasize the death.
Yeah. It's not it. You're saying that Buddha always said about striving and effort, and I always talk about letting go on these retreats. And is it because that these days we strive so much? And no, even in those days they strive just as hard. And the great things about researching the Vinaya, they've got all these stories of what people were like in the time of the Buddha. And they still do the same naughty things that they do now. And sometimes you see the same things happening in Bodhidharma Monastery, which happened 2,500 years ago. The same silly things which people do. You know, playing jokes on each other and goodness knows what else. And you see that people just do not change. But it's the effort to stop. It's the effort for that donkey to learn not to keep going, but to restrain itself. It's the effort of restraint, the effort of stopping, the effort of letting go, the effort to be kind and gentle. Because that goes against the grain of our habits, it takes effort to learn how to stop. So the fire is on the head, it's effort to put it out, the effort to stop things. It's the effort to stop. So every time you're driving a car and you see this wonderful stop sign there, that was written there by the Buddha. That's Dharma. Every time you get the red light, that's the Dhamma. You should get enlightened every time you get stuck in a traffic jam. Stop. Yes, I understand now. So always remember the stop signs are where you should understand the Dhamma. I was told this years ago, and I think I wrote this in the book, but I've been to Delhi a couple of times. I've never actually seen this. People actually told me that in Delhi, at the red traffic lights, they don't have stop. They have R-E-L-A-X, relax, for the traffic signs. I've never seen that, but it would be a great thing if we did have that. So when you get to the traffic junctions, and you get the big red light, instead of saying stop, it's relax. That's what you're doing here. Relax. So you've got to stop. Stop in this moment. And stop running off till tomorrow afternoon. Tomorrow afternoon is a long way from now. So see if you can train yourself to enjoy every moment and don't allow tomorrow to come until you're there. Otherwise you're wasting so much of the retreat. If you've already packed your bags, you might as well leave this morning. Unpack them. Okay. Oh, you got away. Go.
I was just wondering, when that hits the stop, is that making also a very deep, detailed decision to cope with a lot more of the unknown in your life?
Yeah.
Because you just may have lots of ideas about the way things would work, etc., but you just consciously decide, no, I'm not going to be either one, give it importance, two, put focus, mental effort, and try to sort it out, except that you just don't know a great deal of what's happening.
Correct, yes, so number three is the best one. Is it permanent? You don't know what's going to happen. So you make tentative plans, but not that many plans. It's uncertain we're going to finish at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Who knows? We may carry on for another week. Who knows that someone here, we might find out that someone from, say, Singapore has brought bird flu. And we're all quarantined in this Redemptorist monastery for another month. And no one can go home. It's possible. So you better unpack your bags. We're stuck here for another month, folks. So do you think that actually happened in real life? Sometimes you don't know what's going to happen next. Yes.
You've spoken a lot during this retreat about expectations, you know, having expectations.
Yes.
But is that also attachment?
Yes.
And the thing is, science and meditation, you know, you can work really, really hard at something with a huge amount of effort. And that's fine if you're not expecting a result or not attached to a result.
But sometimes, if you're putting a lot of effort into something, you're working so hard, what are you putting so much effort into it for? If it's actually just for the fun of it, fine. In other words, it's the fun of what's happening now. But if it's for the fun of it when it's finished, like a lot of people do, only another day to enjoy, come on, just enjoy, and then afterwards I'll be happy. And then the next thing you do, only another day, I have to enjoy at work, and then go on a retreat again. So while you're on a retreat, you can't wait to get back. While you're back home, you can't wait to go on the next retreat. That's what happens when people go on holiday. They can't wait to go on holiday. As soon as they go on holiday, they can't wait to go back home. Sorry?
The thing that strikes me is that there are some things that require effort.
Yeah.
This building wasn't built without effort. And
yeah.
You have to drop the effort to pick it up, they're not there without effort. So some effort is worthwhile and has to be put in. What roots it is that attachment to a result.
But correct, yeah. Oh, yeah, effort is sometimes good in the world. But it's true, it's like, you know, having built monasteries, or, yeah, a couple of monasteries, I suppose, with some of what Nana Chat, but certainly here in Bodhinyana Monastery. And having all of that work in there, you can see that sometimes you sacrifice your happiness in the present moment for some so-called future goal. And then the building is never beautiful. So the best way of building is just enjoying every day of the work. So it's not for the end result is what you're doing for, it's actually doing it for the happiness of doing it now. So every pick you enjoy, make it a nice pick and have fun with it. And then the end, the building is a beautiful building. You get the point there? So the effort should not be striving and getting it out of the way to get something in the future.
That's going to be my last question.
Yeah.
Effort does not have to be unenjoyable.
Correct.
Hard, or anything from the effort.
That's right. And that time sometimes people, you know, you're putting forth a lot of work into it, but it looks effortless because you're having fun. Look at kids playing. They work so hard, but they have fun. So it wouldn't be a wonderful thing, you know, if we smiled at work and said, oh, can you do this extra assignment? You say, yes, I'd love to do the extra assignment. And can you work late this tonight? Yes, I'd love to work late. Can you stay on the weekend? Yes, I'd love to stay on the weekend. Always a nice fun. The point is, if you have to do it, you might as well make it fun. But a lot of times when people in their work, they just get so grumpy. Oh, why me? Why do I always have to give the talks every day? Why do people always come to me with a problem? There's supposed to be only meditation problems in that room. When a marriage and then being a mother, being a daughter, goodness knows what else comes up in that room. I think, why me? Why do you ask me about your marriage? I'm a monk, for goodness sake. But of course, you never get it. You see me in that room, you never get upset. You just enjoy it. So this is what I have to do as a monk, so enjoy it. So whatever you have to do, and sometimes I do some really weird things. I told you one of the weirdest things I ever did was, it was in 6PR, the radio station, just off on the end of Adelaide Terrace. Adelaide Terrace? No, Hay Street somewhere, I think. And so I know a couple of people in there, say, can you come and do a radio show? Just, I think it was one evening. I think it was one, I think it might be a Friday, just after the ordinary talk at Dhammaloka. So I rocked up there at 10 o'clock. And, you know, I went straight into the studio. You put the headphones on in front of the microphone. And then just before we went on air, they just introduced me to this lady sitting next to me. Said, oh, this is Dr. Gabriel Morrissey. She's a sex expert. What the heck of a show am I doing? And it was on adult themes. So there I was, a monk, fielding questions on sex and, you know, your performance for the next 2 hours. You can get very upset about that. But I really had good fun on that. I really enjoyed myself. So that's actually what you have to do. Just enjoy yourself. And then your life is no effort. You put a lot of work in and people think, wow, you just worked so hard. But it's effortless. If you understand what I mean. So, you know, sometimes people look at the schedules of when I go overseas and give someone the talks, but I really have fun. Enjoy it. And that way it's effortless. Fun is energy. And energy is fun. And it becomes, you know, you put effort into things, but it's, in one sense, effortless from inside. On the outside it looks like effort. On the inside it's just playing with life. Does that make any sense? Okay, so now we have interviews, because it's getting late and there's many interviews here. This morning the list is... Yeah?
I don't
need
any
excuses,
so someone wants
to
yeah. I've
my anyone else disappearing? That's two people who have been enlightened by this morning's talk. Anyone else been enlightened? Don't need any interviews anymore? No. Okay, well thanks. So, we have... Well, that's only a few this morning. Okay, then there's a full list this afternoon. And if you get enlightened in the morning, please cross your name off the list. So that you don't need any more interviews ever again. So we're interviews this afternoon. And again, this evening I'll be going off to Nolamara Centre, and so you have the opportunity to ask your questions from the other monks so they can have to do some work. And I'm sure it's going to be effortless for them because they're going to have fun as well and enjoy it. You will enjoy, okay? You will be a control freak abbot. And we'll be back tomorrow morning for the chanting and the last morning talk. Tomorrow, if it's okay on Saturday, no interviews on Saturday morning, because it'd be nice just to sit with you and just have a nice quiet time. And then after that we have our lunch, and in the afternoon, I think we're supposed to be finishing off at 3 o'clock, so you know, you can do whatever you need to do until 2 o'clock, and 2 o'clock you can get everyone in here to do some meditation together. And at the end of towards the end of the meditation, I'll do a loving-kindness meditation, and followed in the end by some chanting. There was a note by my seat here, so, you know, can we do some loving-kindness and spreading some healing for Wadi Nut, you know, the lady with cancer in a wheelchair. So we can do that tomorrow, but it's also not just for her, for everybody who's sick, either sick in the body or sick in the head. I'm not looking at anybody. So we can do the healings for everybody tomorrow. And we'll finish off about 3 o'clock, and there I'll give a sort of a little blessing at the end, and that finishes off the retreat. So she'll finish about 3 o'clock, because sometimes, saying that you don't need to plan anything, sometimes the people need to get a lift or something, but 3 o'clock we finish. Okay, so now we have the interviews.